Chapter 3. Monlow Harbour, Nerth, 2 days later. Though John Grammaticus was over 1,000 years old, he had only been Conig Henniker for 8 months, and he was still getting used to the idea. According to his file, and as far as any imperial methods of scrutiny were concerned, Conig Henniker was a 52-year-old man from a region of Terra known as the Caucasus, and he served in the Imperial Army as an intelligence officer attached to the Geno 5-2 Chiliad. Grammaticus still thought of himself as essentially human. He had been born human, raised as a human, and he had been human when, to all intents and purposes, he had died for the first time. Definitions became a little more complicated after that. One thing was certain: at some non-specific point after his first death, probably as the result of a slow process rather than a sudden change of heart, he had stopped being quite so steadfast in his devotion to the interests of his birth species. He was still unashamedly fond of the human race, and was a stout apologist for its less edifying qualities, but he had been with the Cabal for a long time, and they had shared the acuity with him, at least in part. These days he saw what his birth race had once been wont to call the long view. Grammaticus was one of the last few humans still working as an agent of the Cabal. Over the centuries, the Cabal had recruited a good many human go-betweens, but most of them were long dead, forgotten, or disavowed. The Cabal had been recruiting human agents for as long as there had been humans to recruit, a fact Grammaticus always found particularly hard to reconcile. At the very start of human history, before writing, before Ur and Cattle Hayek, before Mohenjo-Daro and Thebes, before the construction of the Lost Monuments, the Cabal had visited Terra and encountered a breed of unprepossessing, unpromising mammalian hominids busy making its first axe marks on the trunks of ancient woodland trees to mark out its first boundaries. The Cabal had seen some particular quality in those mammalian hominids. They had recognized that the hominids would one day rise inexorably to play a pivotal role in the scheme of all things. Mankind would become the greatest weapon against the primordial annihilator, or it would become the primordial annihilator's greatest weapon. Either way, the Cabal decided that the unprepossessing mammalian hominids, developing on that backwater world, were not a species to be dismissed. Grammaticus knew that this fact frustrated most of the Cabal's inner circle. They were old kinds, every damn one of them, and regarded all the upstart species of the galaxy as inferior ephemera. It pained them to accept that their destiny, all destinies, lay in the purview of creatures that had been simple single-cell protocytes when the old kind cultures were already mature. Garhet had once told Grammaticus that the Cabal had made its first subtle advances towards the human species long before the advent of the Age of Terror. Garhet had said this bitterly, and more bitterly still had admitted the Cabal's repeated failure to apply influence on human development. "You've always been feral, stubborn brutes," Garhet had said. "Shockingly dogmatic in your self-worth. We tried to direct you and influence your course. It was like..." Garhet had paused, allowing his mind to select an appropriately humanocentric simile. "It was like commanding a tide to turn back," he finished. Grammaticus had smiled. "We are a headstrong people, aren't we?" he had replied, with no little pride. "Did you not think it might have been easier to cull us before we grew teeth?" Garhet had nodded, or at least he had flexed his secondary nostrils in a mannerism that equated to a nod. "That was not our way, then. We all deem such notions as gross barbarism. All of us except Slough Da, of course. Of course. And now? Now I regret we did not abort you when we had the chance. Destruction has become our only tool in latter days. I miss the subtle methods. Almost all of the humans recruited down the years had proved to be unviable or flawed. Most had been disposed of. Grammaticus believed that he had succeeded where so many others had failed because of his gift. John Grammaticus was a high-function psyker. The Uxor will see you, Head Henniker, the subaltern in the fur shako announced. Thank you, John Grammaticus replied, and got up off the wooden chair at the end of the corridor. He walked down the hall towards the briefing room door, straightening his double-breasted jacket and cape. He undid the collar buttons of his shirt. It was almost noon, and the terracotta palace was sweltering. Situated 15 kilometres outside Mon Lo Harbour, the palace had been commandeered as a control station for the advance. Its ancient walls held the day's heat like an oven. Reed screens soaked in water had been fixed over the windows to keep the palace interiors cool and fresh, but they were beginning to dry out. John Grammaticus had no physiological need to perspire, but he permitted his body to do so. Every other human around was sweating freely, and he didn't want them to notice that he wasn't like them. He knocked at the door.
Come,
he went in. The chamber was long and broad, with pillars flanking the walls to support the tiled ceiling. The tops of the pillars had been carved to resemble the fronds of reeds or snapping crocodilia, both common features in Nerthine architecture. A folding steel table had been set up in the centre of the room, and Uxor Ruxana stood at the head of it. Her four aides ranged on either side of the table beside her. Uxor, Grammaticus said. Good to see you. He tapped his throat. I apologize for the unbuttoning, but this objectionable heat...
Quite all right, Conic, she replied.
Her aides all nodded accordingly. They were all female, all aged between 13 and 16, Uxors in waiting. Their ovaries had already been harvested for the Geno 5-2 Chiliad stock banks. They were now honing their sept powers and acting as a support buffer for their assigned Uxor. Grammaticus found the operational structure of the Geno 5-2 Chiliad quite fascinating. Formed during the savage continental wars that had engulfed Terra at the end of the Age of Strife, the Geno had proved to be a most effective and adaptable force. No wonder the Emperor had permitted them to endure after unification. No wonder he had looked upon their system and stolen from it. The Geno practiced genic mustering. Grammaticus had been thoroughly briefed on this. Genic mustering had been an essential tool during those caustic years of atomic hurricanes and drifting rad clouds. The core of the regiment was the Uxors, a bloodline of latent, psychically sensitive females. The females had their eggs harvested at puberty, and from them the heavy-built uterine soldiery of the unit were vat-grown, using the genetic codes of several proven, robust agnate gene pools, notorious for their martial merit. The Geno grew tough warriors, but they complemented their brute strength and kept the pool clean by importing smart, proven field commanders from other forces. The Hetmen were always non-stock individuals who excelled at tactics and strategy. The Uxors at the top of the Chiliad's command tree were no longer capable of carrying children of their own to term. This, in ways not entirely understood, freed their minds and allowed them to operate as perceptives, operational coordinators who could appreciate, as Garhet had put it during the briefing, the behaviour of their children. At best, the Uxors were weak psychers. Each one was capable of a rudimentary talent known as the sept, enough to enable their forces in the field and supply them with some insight. They burned out quickly. By 26, 27, they were done as Uxors and restricted to other duties. During their active phase as perceptives, they were always accompanied by aides, Uxors in training, whose raw psychic talent bolstered the septive power of their Uxor even as they learned from her. None of the females in the chamber possessed a fraction of John Grammaticus's talent. As he sat down at the end of the table, opposite Uxor Roxana, he reached out. Instantly, he tasted feeble, immature septs, chitter-chatter minds, the moist, unwholesome mental architecture of the pubescent aides. The technical inability to conceive made most Uxor aides gruesomely promiscuous. Grammaticus was repelled by the lurid, shallow thoughts that washed towards him. The aides were all thinking about the next soldier boy they'd hump, or how fabulous it was going to be to become an Uxor. Roxana was different. Grammaticus looked down the table towards her. For a start, she was a woman, not a girl. A startlingly appealing woman. Her lips were full, her long, straight, blonde hair centre-parted, her eyes heavily lashed and exotically grey. A master sculptor could not have improved upon her cheekbones. She was also 28 and at the end of her Uxor service. He could feel that she hated this fact. She was broken by the thought that she would soon be something else, a medicae, a munitorum commander, a cartomancer, an Uxor emeritus. Her powers were ebbing. Her sept was waning and weakening. "What do you have for me, sir?" she asked. Quite a voice. Even the aides took notice. Husky. No, silky, like honey. Grammaticus knew he was a little in love with her and allowed himself to relish the fact. It had been a long time, 700 years, give or take, since he had permitted himself to respond to a human female in any way other than physical need. "Well, I have plenty, Uxor," he replied, taking out the document case from under his arm and opening it.
"You've actually been in Monlow Harbour?" asked one of the aides, looking right at him.
Grammaticus felt a wash of admiring lust.
"Yes? What's your name?"
"Tuvi, sir," the girl said.
She was the most mature of Roxana's aides, about 19. Tuvi clearly found the idea of a daring intelligence officer quite intoxicating.
"Yes, Tuvi. I made cover as a merchant called Dasal Hulta, and spent the last 4 days gathering evidence in the inner quarters of the town."
Amongst other things, he thought.
"Wasn't that terribly dangerous?" asked another of the aides.
"Yes, it was," said Grammaticus.
"How were you not unmasked by the infidel enemy?" asked Tuvi.
"Be quiet," Roxana told her girls. "Intelligence operatives are hardly required to give away their tricks."
"It's all right, Uxor," Grammaticus smiled. He looked at Tuvi and said, "El te tanash el et she tane."
"What?" Tuvi replied.
"It means," Grammaticus told her, "I speak the local language as a native does, in Nerthin." "But," Tuvi began,
"My dear, I'm not going to tell you how, so please don't ask.
If I might continue?"
Tuvi looked as if she was going to say something else.
"Let the man speak, Tuvi," Roxana snapped. "Henneke?"
Of course. Well, the location itself, as we know, the Nerthin have no orbital or interplanetary technology, nor have ever possessed such means. However, the area known as Monlow Harbour, though flooded and used for maritime shipping, was originally constructed as a setting down point for starships. Uxor Roxana blinked.
"For starships?" she echoed.
He was taking a slight risk in sharing this information, but John Grammaticus's mind was finely trained to sort and appraise data. He knew exactly what he could give up and what he couldn't. He believed it mattered very little if the Imperials found out that Mon Lo had once been an extraplanetary set-down. It was a halting sight, in fact. The Cabal used to visit here long ago. That's why they knew about the Nerthine culture. For starships, Uxor.
Are you sure? Uxor Roxana asked.
Absolutely, Grammaticus replied. I have excellent sources.
And when you say originally, Conic, what does originally mean?
It means something between 8,000 and 12,000 years ago. Enough time for sea levels to change, for floodplains to rise, and for a massive, stone-cut, extraplanetary harbour to fill with water and become a harbour of a more traditional nature. It was 11,826 years, in fact, and the construction work had taken 18 months. Grammaticus felt it wise to fudge the precision of his knowledge. The aides started speaking all at once.
That would place construction during the second age of technology, said one.
Around the time of the first contact event and the first alien wars, said another.
Is there any evidence as to which xenoform might have been responsible? Asked another. Do the Nerthine know of its provenance? Asked Tuvi.
Tuvi frames the best question, said Grammaticus, shutting down the chatter. Do they know? Well, I don't believe they do. They possess myths and legends, as all cultures do, and some of them contain elements that might be interpreted as containing some race memory of Xeno contact or intervention. But until the 670th expedition came along, the Nerthine believed they were alone in the galaxy. Remember, the Nerthine don't even realize they were originally colonists from Terra.
That is the true misery of this war, Roxana nodded. They do not recognize us as kin.
Grammaticus felt her discomfort. Kinship meant so much to the Geno Uxors. Indeed, he found this aspect of the Emperor's great crusade especially troubling. In its youth, mankind had spilled out across the stars, colonizing thousands of worlds, forming the first human stellar community. Then the age of strife had come down, like the blade of a guillotine, and for the better part of 5,000 years, warp storms had rendered interstellar travel impossible. The outreaches of man had become cut off, beleaguered, isolated. In that turmoil, many offshoots had entirely forgotten who they were or where they had come from. Such was the case with Nerth. When the Emperor, a figure long foreseen by the Cabal, had finally unified the anarchic fragments of Terra, he had undertaken a great crusade. Oh, how telling was that title! To seek out and reconnect with the lost outposts of the human race. It was astonishing how often the lost worlds resisted those overtures of reconnection. It was unconscionable how many times the roving expedition fleets had been forced to go to war with the very cultures they had set out to rescue and embrace, just to bring them to what the Emperor had euphemistically called compliance. It was always, so the official line went, for their own good. John Grammaticus had met the Emperor once, close on 1,000 years before. The Emperor had been just another feudal warlord then, leading his thunder-armoured troops in an effort to consolidate his early strife-age victories and pave the way to eventual unification. Grammaticus had been a line officer in the Caucasian levies, a significant force inveigled by truce and pact to support the Emperor's assault on the territorial holdings of the Pan-Pacific tyrant Duma. After a bloody conquest at Bactria, Grammaticus had been one of 100 Caucasian officers invited to a triumph at Pash, hosted by the retinues of the Thunderbolt and Lightning Army. During the festivities, the Emperor, even then he had been known only by that objectionable epithet, had grandly toured the tables to personally thank his foreign allies and the leaders of the mercenary clans.
Grammaticus had been one of hundreds present to receive his grateful handshake. In that moment of contact, he had seen why the Emperor was a force to be reckoned with. A psyche of towering, unimaginable strength, not really human at all by any contemporary measure of the fact. Grammaticus, who had never met anyone else like himself, had shuddered and felt like a drone insect in the presence of its hive king. The Emperor had felt Grammaticus in the same passing second of contact. He had smiled. "You have a fine mind, John," he had said, without having to ask Grammaticus his name. "We should talk and consider the options available to beings like us." Before any such conversation could happen, Grammaticus had died, that painful, stupid first death. Looking back, Grammaticus wondered if he would ever have been able to influence the Emperor's course if he'd lived. He doubted it. Even then, in that tiny moment of connection, it had been clear that the Emperor was never going to turn away from the road of catastrophic bloodshed he was set upon. One day, he would unleash upon the galaxy the most dreadful killing machines of all, the Astartes. How ironic it was that Grammaticus's current task was to broker cooperation with one of those fearsome Astartes legions. Garhet had once remarked to Grammaticus that the Emperor was the only human who would ever have made a viable addition to the Cabal's inner circle. "He sees the long picture of it," Garhet had said. "He understands the vast, slow cycle and is content to allow it to run its course. He appreciates the epochal dynamic of true and thorough change." "Have you ever met him?" Grammaticus had asked. "No, John, I haven't." "Then you have no idea what a bloodthirsty bastard he really is," Garhet had smiled. "That's as maybe, but he understands that the primordial annihilator is the true enemy of everything, so perhaps we need a bloodthirsty bastard on our side."
"Konig."
"I'm sorry, Uxor," Grammaticus said. Roxana smiled down the table at him.
"You were quite lost in thought."
"I was. I apologize. Where was I? It is my belief that the extraplanetary harbor was built by some Xenos kind several hundred years before this world was colonized by the original human outships. As far as the Nerthine are concerned, it has always been here."
"So it is an intriguing aside and not pertinent to our combat evaluation?"
"Indeed not. But for all their parochial mindset, the Nerthine have an appreciation of extraplanetary matters. They have lived in fear of first contact, of discovery by beings from other worlds. In their doctrine, our arrival proves to them the universal presence of evil. There is no dealing with them."
"None at all?"
"No, Uxor." He wanted to tell her that they were dealing with a human culture that had succumbed to the corruption of the primordial annihilator. But he knew she simply wouldn't understand what chaos meant. Very few humans did. Grammaticus did, because he had shared the Cabal's acuity. He had a feeling, deep in his gut, that the Emperor knew all too well. So why hadn't he told any of his children? Why hadn't he forewarned them about the deathless abomination they would encounter if they ventured out into the stars? The briefing turned to matters of fortification and placement. Grammaticus had brought the plans he had carefully hand-drawn. Discussion began on the best practice of attack on Mon Loh. Tuvi surprised him by suggesting the most perceptive tactical solutions. She would be a full Uxor soon, with a pack of aides of her own. Roxana let her lead the plotting, nodding contentedly at her stepdaughter's excellence. As the talk went to and fro, Grammaticus decided, willfully, it was time to switch places
He put himself behind Ruxana's eyes. She was far too preoccupied to resist or even notice, and looked back down the table at himself. He saw what she saw. A well-made man of mature years, strong in the back and arms, with a very handsome face and grey hair. The man wore a scarlet dress coat with ornate double frogging down the front, and he was perspiring very slightly. Not bad, thought John Grammaticus. Not bad at all. It wasn't the body he'd been born with, but at least it pretended to be from the Caucasus, which was where the first John Grammaticus had been born, towards the end of the 29th millennium.
If we are going to commit to an attack, Tuvi was saying, we need to know more about the enemy disposition in these lines, and along the north wall, here, and here.
I wasn't able to collect data, Grammaticus replied. But you're right, I'll be going in again tomorrow. In 3 days I should have the information you need.
Good, said Ruxana. She paused. You're going inside again?
I think it's necessary, Uxur.
Then may the Emperor protect you, Tuvi said, and several of the aides echoed her.
Oh, I'm quite sure he won't, Grammaticus thought.
That's all for today, Ruxana told her aides. Be off with you. I'll finish the brief myself.
Grammaticus sensed annoyance and disappointment as the aides filed out. The door closed behind them. There was a long silence.
Where were we?
Uxur Ruxana asked.
You were about to undress, he said, in demotic Scythian.
Was I indeed? She laughed, answering in the same language. I had no idea you were fluent in my native tongue, or knew me to be of Scythian extraction. You're very clever, Conic.
You don't know the half of it, he thought. I'm fluent instantly in every tongue, every language I encounter. It's my particular talent and my curse.
I'm sorry to be forward, he said, again in Scythian, but I've seen the way you look at me.
And I've seen the way you look at me, sir.
Is it so bad?
Ruxana smiled.
No, Conic, it's flattering. But I'm no aide carder hussy. I'm not about to disrobe for some sordid little tryst in this briefing room. I'm not sure I'm going to disrobe for you at all.
Grammaticus allowed a smile to cross Henniker's face.
My dear Uxur, he said, the simple doubt expressed in that sentence is all I could ever ask for.
In the old times, in the time of incoation, races built their fastnesses in places of safety and left the darker places unexplored. It had been the primitive instinct of man to behave this way. It had kept him safe from the wolf and the saber cat. Grammaticus wished his species had kept hold of this instinct and not forsaken it. The darker places were darker places for a reason. He was fairly certain it was the eternal influence of the Emperor that had quashed that particular taboo. He thought of Terra's old maps, with their quaintly phrased notations of warning, "Here be dragons." That had always been a shorthand motto of man's ignorance of the darker places of his universe.
"What did you say?"
Ruxana asked, rolling over sleepily.
"Nothing," he replied.
"You said something about dragons, Conic."
"I may have."
"There are no dragons, Conic."
It was late afternoon. The palace compound had sweltered out another day. So close to the sea, everyone could smell it, yet so far away, its cooling influence did not reach. The sex had been exceptional. The emotional intimacy had almost reduced him to tears. He hated allowing himself to get so close. 700 years was a long time,
long enough for him to forget the consequences of proper connection. He had felt her hunger, her appetite to prove she was still something of significance, even though her Uxorhood was sloughing away like dead skin. He had allowed himself to love her, and allowed her to reciprocate. And now he faced up to the consequences of that decision.
Connick?
She didn't even know his real name. He wanted to tell her.
Do you have to go back in?
She asked, rolling over and lying sidelong. Her lithe, naked body made him stir, but he resisted the temptation. Yes.
I'm sure we can do the rest of the tactical plan with drone spotters and the fleet appraisal.
You can't. You need me in there.
John?
Oh, no.
Oh, no what? She asked, sitting up.
He rose to his feet. Nothing, my love.
My love, that sounds very serious.
John, not now.
You've gone quite pale, Con. Are you all right?
He paced away from the bed, barefoot, towards the washroom.
I'm fine, absolutely fine. I just need a sip of water.
Roxana rolled onto her back and stared at the ceiling.
Don't be long, she called.
Grammaticus entered the washroom, closed the door behind him and paused for a moment, head down, leaning his hands on the edges of the stone basin.
Not now, really not now, he moaned softly.
The stone was cool under his palms. He poured some water into it from the jug. All the while he could feel the old chipped mirror hanging on the wall behind him. He turned around. Garhet looked out at him from the mirror's cloudy surface.
You have taken a wrong step, John Grammaticus. The intimate bond you have made with this female is impairing your mission. Go away. John, you are risking everything. You know what's at stake. What are you doing?
Being human for a change, Grammaticus replied.
John, we have eliminated agents for less.
I'm sure you have. Not in the old days, but in these latter days. I am sure you have.
I am not threatening you, John.
Yes, you actually are, he told the mirror.
The galaxy must live.
Right, right. And can I be allowed to live in it a little? Garhet's face faded slowly. Grammaticus rinsed his face in cold water from the stone basin.
Bastards, he spat.
Before dawn, in a cool mauve twilight, the escort arrived to take Grammaticus back to the insertion point. He had already been up for an hour, ritually packing and repacking his small bag. He told the escort to wait with the vehicle and finished his chores, sipping tepid black caffeine and eating some preserved fruits and spelt bread left over from the night before. She surprised him by waking up.
Were you planning on leaving without a goodbye?
No, he lied.
Good.
Roxana brushed a strand of long blonde hair off her face and looked him up and down. He had dressed in a simple desert suit of soft brown kidskin with army-issue boots and a canvas jacket.
You don't look much like a native.
That part comes later. All she was wearing was the sheet from the bed.
Well, goodbye then. The Emperor protects.
Let's hope so, he agreed.
Try to come back, Roxana said. I'd like to see you again.
I'll come back, he replied, not lying this time, because I want to see you again. Uxor Roxana smiled and tilted her head slightly to one side, regarding him.
There's something about you, Connick. It's as if you see right into me.
That's because I do, he said.
The escort, a young Gino Company Bashaw, and three sleepy troopers were waiting for him in the rear yard of the palace compound. The ride was a light speeder, the hull of which had been sandblasted back to bare metal by the environment.
"Sir," the Bashaw saluted as Grammaticus walked out of the lit doorway into the darkness of the yard with his bag over his shoulder. It took a second to place the man's background accent. Indonesia, Purwakarta Administrative District, perhaps one of the Sianjur hives.
"What's your unit?" Grammaticus asked in Bahasa Malay. The Bashaw blinked in surprise and smiled.
"Arakni, sir," he replied. "I didn't know you were a panpak, sir."
"I'm not. I'm from all over."
They got in and rode out of the yard and through the descending levels of the ancient desert palace, via checkpoints, gateways and night-watch barricades, where sentries lurked beside sputtering braziers, their rifles hooked through their folded arms. Papers and biometrics were routinely checked. The Nerthine had a subversive streak. Experience had taught the Imperial Army that the Nerthine had spies of their own. Saboteurs, too. It felt odd to be a spy checked on the way out. Outside the palace perimeter, the speeder picked up velocity and coasted along the bombed-out avenues and dust-dressed streets of the township surrounding the compound. The sun was threatening to rise behind the passing ruins. Grammaticus sat back in the rear seat, trying to relax, trying to compose his focus into identity immersion, feeling the breeze of motion against his face. He began to regret making a connection with the young Bashaw. The officer, sitting up front, kept leaning around and talking to Grammaticus about places in Sianjur that Grammaticus had never visited, nor had any wish to visit. Grammaticus had been in Sianjur once, long ago. He'd been there as part of an army that had burned the place down 500 years before the hive the Bashaw had grown up in had even been planned. He closed his eyes and thought of Ruxana.
"It's as if you see right into me."
There was too much truth in that. His mind saw into everything. It made him think of the thing he tried never to think about. That day, long ago, meeting the Emperor, shaking his hand, tasting the power, and seeing behind the glamour of that handsome, noble, healthy face, seeing, just for a nanosecond, seeing.
"Are you quite well, sir?" the Bashaw asked. "You went rather pale all of a sudden. Is it motion sickness?"
"No, I'm fine. Absolutely fine," Grammaticus replied.
They came up out of the ruins and followed the rutted dispersal tracks around the back of the dug-in Imperial lines. The sun was rising, crisping the lower edge of the sky. In the lee of the earthworks, for kilometre after kilometre, gun emplacements made sulking silhouettes against the dawn, and millions of bivouac tents covered the ground like blisters, breakfast fires glowing. They passed standards and banners hanging limp in the slowly heating air. "That's my lot," the Bashaw called out as they shot past a particular standard. Grammaticus turned his head to look and saw Arachne, a mousy but surprisingly large-bosomed girl, if the banner's image was any guide, weaving her complex web of fate and destiny. The insertion point was an outfall of the city's antique sewer system, some 18 kilometres west of the palace. It had been exposed by shelling about 3 months earlier and was well guarded. Apart from the Gino sentries, automated gun servitors watched it, unblinking, day and night. The Nerthine guarded the other end just as proficiently, but Grammaticus wasn't going all the way to the other end. The Bashaw introduced him to the point officer, a ruddy-faced hetman called Marino. Marino wanded the servitors to default passive and stood watching with the Bashaw as Grammaticus slithered down the shattered embankment into the maw of the outfall. Darkness, as had so often been the case in his life, embraced him. 10 kilometres and 90 minutes later,
He pulled himself out of a runoff vent not far from the rising walls and banked towers of Monlo Harbour. He had already switched off his lamp and left it in the bag, along with his canvas jacket and army boots stuffed behind the loose bricks of a culvert. His journey along the dark chute had provided him with almost enough time to complete his identity immersion. He was no longer Konig Henniker. He was Dasal Hulte. In all, he had taken very few real measures to disguise himself. A wrap of pink silk over his desert suit, felt shoes in place of the army boots, a desert shawl expertly pulled around his head. His skin was tanned, though not as dark as the average Nerthine, and a strict Nerthine observer of the Pachkel would have worn his hair tied in a net under his shawl and anointed his scalp, armpits, groin and belly with scented oil. Grammaticus never went to such extremes, even though his imperial spymasters recommended he should. He knew that his mind was more than capable of smoothing over most epistemological blemishes. Besides, the anointing oils smacked of a ritual offering to the primordial annihilator, something he was not prepared to undertake. He fastened the hooked knife worn by all Nerthine to his underbelt, then strapped on the broad overbelt with its three pouches for fluid, mineral salt, and currency. He washed his hands in the trackside dust to blacken his fingernails. Apart from the knife, he carried no weapon, except, of course, for the ring. The sun was crawling up into the sky, having revealed itself during his trek through the dank underworld. He felt its searing heat on his head and shoulders, but he was near the sea, close enough to both feel and smell it. Fresh winds came in from the harbour shore, snaking in across the desert outland. He sniffed moisture. He began to walk towards the banked towers and enamelled walls of the port city. Others were doing the same. War or no war, life went on. Straggles of traders and merchants, some with trains of pack animals, were heading into Monlo from the hinterland, hoping to do business at the city markets. Migrant workers were walking to the port in search of employment. Refugees and displaced citizens were coming to the gates, fleeing the imperial advance. Grammaticus fell in with them. As he walked, Grammaticus began the psychic litany in his head, the final progression towards immersion in another dialect and culture base. I am John Grammaticus. I am John Grammaticus. I am John Grammaticus pretending to be Konig Henniker. I am Konig Henniker. I am Konig Henniker pretending to be Dasal Hulte. I am Dasal Hulte. Ice Dasal Hulte lem pretending. Elche Dasal Saman Hulte lem tanayek. Elche Dasal Saman Hulte lem tanayek. Who are you, fellow? One of the Ekvenuth warriors at the city gate asked as he approached. The Ekvenuth had been resting his falks against his silver breastplate, but now he raised it. Some of his companions did likewise. Others were stopping and searching some water merchants heading in out of the desert through the ancient arch. I am Dasal Hulte, Grammaticus replied in demotic Nerthine, making the obeisance of all the sunlight to the Ekvenuth. I am a merchant. Falks held ready across the left shoulder to strike, the Ekvenuth stared at Grammaticus. Show me your palms, your face, and your brands. Grammaticus made as if to do so. I'm safe, and you've seen all you need to reassure you. He sent at the same moment. The Ekvenuth nodded and waved him into the city, already sweeping the incomers for his next subject. Grammaticus had shown him nothing. Monlo was waking up. As a city girded to the expectation of assault, it never truly slept, but its habits followed a circadian ebb and flow. The outer walls were well defended by squadrons of Ekvenuth, by iron mortars and bombasts, and by platoons of the regular Nerthadra ground troops. They loitered in unruly, spitting gatherings around the heavy steps of the city's thick walls,
or stood on the wall's fighting platforms, watching the distant, unmoving enemy through spyglasses. Deeper in the city, the rhythmic pulse of life was easier to discern. Markets woke up, merchants announced their wares, morning devotions were declaimed by strong-lunged priests, water carriers called their services as they wandered the plazas and the winding cobbled streets and lanes. Grammaticus retraced his steps, trying to recall the specific layout of the place as he had experienced it the first time. Passing merchants and elders nodded and made the all-the-sunlight gesture to him as they acknowledged his status. He made the gesture back. Grammaticus wanted to get into the northern suburb, an area called Kurnaul, so he could get a good look at the city's north wall. Tuvi would appreciate his efforts. He stood aside to let a Grox cart trundle past. Street washers cleaned the cobbles with bristle brooms and pails of water, using spades for the animal dung. They sang as they worked. The faience-tiled walls of the port city glimmered around him in the morning sun, showing reeds and reptiles in mosaic. The Nerthine had no street names, just pictorial emblems. He looked at a particular symbol, a great monitor lizard delineated in cherry red tiles, and knew, with a trained certainty, that he had never seen it before. He'd made a wrong turn. Monlo was so complex, so interwoven, it was hard to recall the specific plan. It was like Arachne's web, mousy, big-bosomed Arachne. He was the needle, he fancied, her needle, moving through the net of fate. He halted and took a moment to consider. His internal compass was out. He checked with the rising sun and established where east was. He slowed his breathing and allowed himself to perspire for a minute, just to stabilize his body. He had his bearings again. He'd just gone a street too far west, that was all. Kurnaul district was over to his left. Except it wasn't. He halted again, refusing to allow panic to dig in. A water carrier came up to him and offered a ladle of water. "No, thank you," Grammaticus said. "God love you anyway," the carrier replied, moving on. Grammaticus shuddered. What the water carrier had actually said, literally translated as, "The primordial annihilator, immolate your living soul." "What's wrong with me?" Grammaticus thought. "Last time I was here, I slipped easily from street to street. This time I'm behaving like an amateur. My head is swimming. This is stupid." He crossed through two more busy streets, looking for familiar landmarks. It felt as if Kurnaul district was further away than ever. It was as if something was distracting him, baffling his abilities. On impulse, he reached into the bag of mineral salts hooked to his broad overbelt and closed his fingers around the meme seed hidden in the salt inside. The seed was the size of an earlobe, set into a small silver clasp. Gahet had given it to him. The seeds, fruited from some xenotype tree on a world somewhere in the Cabal's range of influence, were psychically sensitive. If they grew warm or desiccated in any way, it was a sign that psychic activity was close by. Grammaticus looked at the meme seed. It was always a little warm and dry, because it reacted to his own talents. In his hand, the seed was positively hot, like a burning coal. It had shriveled in its setting. He was in trouble. The meme seed screamed a warning that something was nearby, perhaps something hunting him.
"Dasal! Dasal Hulte!"
Grammaticus looked over his shoulder and saw a portly merchant waving to him. The man had been standing in conversation with a group of his brethren on the steps of a counting house, but he left them to hurry over. Grammaticus quickly put the meme seed away.
"What is his name? His name? You've met him before."
"The Saal, my good fellow," the portly merchant declared, making the all-the-sunlight gesture and adding a bow. I have missed your face at the market these last few days. What news of the firebrick deal we sketched out on our last meeting? Has your supplier delivered?
Hedek. Hedek Rutan. That was his name.
Hedek, my good fellow, I am pained to respond that my supplier has become a goat's maw, Grammaticus answered politely, taking more than it gives. It turns out I can't deliver on that firebrick deal. I apologize.
Hedek waved his pudgy hand.
Oh, don't worry. I quite understand. In these times of hardship and oppression, with the alien siege at our door, things like this happen.
He looked at Grammaticus more earnestly.
You have my fetish, my gene print, yes? Good. We can deal in future. I look forward to receiving your envoy.
I am always your servant, Hedek, Grammaticus mumbled. He made the sign of all the sunlight and added the gesture of the moon's entire as he ended the meeting. He strode on down the length of the street, feeling as uneasy and lost as before. Then he hurried into an open square where the foot traffic was lighter, hoping the freedom of the space would give him room to clear his head and perhaps even identify the source of the psychic activity the seed had detected. Clarity obstinately refused to come. Grammaticus paused and slowly raised his eyes. He was standing in the Pakhel Awan North, the square of the preeminent temple in Monlo. High above him on the temple's tympanum, a bas-relief frieze showed the four properties of the primordial annihilator. Death, ecstasy, mortality, and mutability, blending together into one huge, ghastly symbol of unity. What gross mistake had led his feet here? What clumsy misturn? This was the last place in the city he would have visited voluntarily.
The tympanum symbol seemed to pulse, to throb, pressing his eyeballs back into their sockets. Sunlight flared and buzzed. He gagged and forced hot reflux back down into his gut. His previous visit hadn't been anything like this. It was as if the city had become aware of him and his role as an intruder and had become a web spun to trap him. Someone, something, was playing with him. The vomit wasn't going to stay down. He hurried off into an alley away from the temple precinct and bent over in the shadows to release the acid liquid. It rushed out of him in a geyser. He barely had time to drag his head shawl off. He sank to his knees, trembling and spitting. Two figures, two men who were just dark shadows, were moving down the alley towards him. They weren't rushing, but there was a purposeful, urgent stride to their gait. Grammaticus got to his feet and made off in the opposite direction, with equal purpose, not quite running. Three more figures rounded the opposite end of the long, winding alley and came towards him. What were they? Militia? Ekvenerth? Agents of the Pakhel Awan, the temple's zealous doctrinal clerics? The alley had a couple of side turnings along its length. Grammaticus took the first and broke into a run as soon as he was out of sight of the figures closing in on him. He reached a dead end, a closed courtyard behind some tall, fine townhouses. He heard footsteps approaching behind him. He tried the doors and found all of them bolted, except a heavy gate of painted wood where green reptiles intercoiled and made helical patterns. Grammaticus pushed the gate open and ducked into the blessed cool and darkness of the room beyond. He closed the gate and drew the bolt across to hold it. He waited, listening to the muffled footsteps and voices outside. A gigantic hand, gloved in steel, reached out of the darkness and picked him up by the neck. It turned him around and slammed him back against the wall, holding him by the throat. Grammaticus was being throttled, his feet kicking off the ground. The steel hand pressed him back against the wall. Terracotta brickwork ground into his back.
"I have a suspicion," a deep voice said, coming out of the darkness. "You've been looking for me, John Grammaticus."
It knew his name. That's possible, Grammaticus gasped, though it might depend upon who you are.
My name? You know my name, you treacherous bastard. My name is Alpharius.